WrestleSpective Radio is not affiliated with World Wrestling Entertainment, TNA Wrestling, Ring of Honor Wrestling, or any other sports entertainment entity or personality.
You're listening to WrestleSpective Radio. Learn to love it.
Hello and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio at FairToFlare.com. I'm Jason Mann, and with me today is one of my fellow cohorts at Fair to Flare, Razor from Kickout Wrestling. Hi, Razor.
What's up, brother? Hello.
Not much. So, you've traveled the highway to hell many times, I understand. So
that is true. There are no stop signs, no speed limits.
No, there are not. And we're talking today about SummerSlam 1998, the very famous Stone Cold Steve Austin against Undertaker matchup. And whenever I hear the song Highway to Hell, I cannot possibly help but think of the stories that I've heard of Kevin Dunn and Vince McMahon playing air guitar to AC/DC on Vince McMahon's jet. So that may have sort of ruined the song for me, but oh well.
Well, yeah, living in the Midwest, I'm sure we've also both heard it on the radio every day for the last 25 years. So.
Yes, very possible. Yes.
Yeah. But I do think it's one of the best uses of music to build a match that WWE's done.
I would agree with that. Yeah. And they really did do a pretty slow burn on this match.
They were building that up from when Austin was feuding with Dude Love after he won the title.
Yeah, because it was May over the Edge 98 when Undertaker was in Austin's corner. Like they did the deal where somebody could volunteer, and Undertaker was the one who volunteered, sort of defying Vince. And then they kind of set them up on the path, you know, ever after that. They sort of did one of those weird tag partners who feud kind of things with, I think they did like a, they won the titles at Fully Loaded. July. I think it was a four-way because the New Age Outlaws were champions. I think it was also Mankind and Kane. So there was a lot of that going on. But I would say that 98 was my peak probably of wrestling fandom, at least of that like late 90s Attitude Era time. You know, my youth peak was kind of like 88, I guess. But 98 was kind of that peak. So I was tuned in every week. I was watching Raw and Nitro. I would occasionally even watch like replay. You know, I would tape them and watch them again during the week. So I was definitely very, very into this whole thing.
98 was a great year. I think in terms of the Attitude Era, the Monday Night Wars, that was the peak year, I think would be safe to say, at least in my estimation.
Yeah. I mean, the storytelling, like, you know, there was some of like the tricks that we would later kind of learn of Vince Russo. But like in 98, they were still mostly fresh and new, you know. And they hadn't been like repeated like ad nauseum over and over again. Like 99, it would really kind of those would sort of show up and the stories would really get kind of convoluted and a lot of the stop and start kind of things here. It was kind of the best of both, like the old way of like kind of planning things ahead of time out and outlining it with some of like the more inventive kind of ideas that Russo did bring in and sort of was able to kind of change the WWE partly for good, at least for a while.
Yeah, I mean, at the time, you know, with like Kane winning the WWE title at King of the Ring and then losing it a night later, you know, and that stuff like that we'd never really seen before. I mean, it was like, oh, Kane's got the belt now. That's crazy. And then Austin just beats the shit out of him.
Yes.
But then it worked. And the same thing with going back to Undertaker and Austin, the Uneasy Alliance as tag team champions, you know, that's been done to death every year going into WrestleMania lately.
Sure.
But now, you know, back then it was a relatively new thing that you never really saw a lot of. So yeah, I get what you're saying there.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. So, this is in Madison Square Garden
which always looks so cool.
Yes.
The sets always, cause they put the entrance on the hard camera and it just looks awesome. I'm glad they don't do it all the time, but I love to see it at least once a year.
It's pretty cool. And I like this remix of the Undertaker's music, like one of my favorite versions of
Oh,
his
yeah.
music. It sort of has like the how would you describe it? I'm not good at describing music, but
It's got the you know the badass guitar riff in there that goes with it, and it just sounds like, I mean, it was all part of that evolution of Undertaker's character in the late 90s, you know, not quite at the whole cult Satanist kind of thing going on yet, but he was evolving, not again to the American badass that we saw later, but he was becoming this badass that was just, you know, you were afraid of him, not necessarily because he had superpowers, but he was, you know, terrifying just by himself. He didn't need to make lightning shoot out of his hands, and you know, he wasn't going full on human sacrifice yet, but he was just this dude that will mess you up.
It was a nice middle ground period for that character.
Yeah, I agree.
I think the 99, like the Satanist cult stuff, kind of got a little silly, a
Well,
little
yeah,
goofy,
I mean,
but.
talking Russo, I mean, that was, you know, Russo, you know, personified there with the ridiculousness of stuff that would go in there. Like, okay, now Shane McMahon's teamed up with him. Now Vince is teamed up with him. Now everybody's teamed up with him. It's just, yeah.
Everybody's teaming with everybody. It's yeah. So I like, and then Austin's music comes on, and people go nuts, of course. They had the shattered glass.
Yes. Another thing that I loved about Austin back then was the glass shatter. They didn't always use it, but when they did it just looked so cool.
It was really cool. So I hope if he ever wrestles again, which I know is unlikely, but if it ever happens again, they need to do that for the entrance. They need to do the shattered glass thing. So
I totally agree.
yes. I like that Undertaker, you know, normally, you know, Austin will go up to all four turnbuckles and do his pose and everything, but Undertaker refuses to move from the corner that he is in. And then Austin's like looking at him, like as he's doing his entrance, like, are you going to move? Are you going to move? And then finally they do like a little bit of they don't play it up huge, but he gives him kind of a look, and it's like, okay, you know, you're not gonna back down from me, I guess. So I enjoyed that.
It was the great thing about, again, going to those two characters. One is, you know, the badass, no nonsense guy, and the other one's badass and terrifying. They're just two dudes that didn't really like each other, but they had a mutual respect for each other. But it was just very tense, and I think they played that up really well. Again, talking the build for the match was so good, and everything that they did, every minor thing, it just. You could feel that tension between those two characters.
The one thing that I did think was a little silly, was the Undertaker Kane stuff around this time.
Yeah, because, well, and earlier in the night, you know, Kane was in the dumpster with Mick Foley and bashed him in the face with the sledgehammer and stuff. That was a little over the top, and you didn't really know where they were going with Kane and the Undertaker. Like, are they friends now? It was all part of that. You know,
weird
period.
Yeah, and they went back and forth a lot, and it was just like it felt like they moved so quickly from, you know, Kane and Undertaker hating each other to, okay, now we're pals, and then they'll hate each other pretty quickly, and that was like, I think they tried to get too much mileage out of the Undertaker Kane stuff. Like, it felt like they needed to like get some distance away from that, and then they could have gone back to it eventually. It just felt like they ran that into the ground. When initially, I mean, the original build to the first Undertaker Kane match was awesome. And even a few of the things they did that summer or earlier, like in the spring and summer, were good. But at some point, like it felt like they should have killed that off a few months before they did. And then it led to some really bad matches, particularly in the fall of '98, that we don't need to get into too much. But.
No, I think that a lot of that goes with there was always in the 90s, there was always like, they didn't know what to do with big Undertaker rivals when they were done with the Undertaker. Like, they would bring these guys in, like, oh, this guy's huge and frightening looking. Well, total, he'll be perfect for the Undertaker. And then, you know, they do the whole thing, and the Undertaker eventually comes out on top. And then they don't know what to do with the guy afterwards. Giant Gonzalez springs to mind when I say that. But they always forgot, or they didn't really plan that far ahead. And I always thought, I remember when I was a kid, I was thinking Kane wouldn't be around long because all the Undertaker opponents, the guys that were brought in specifically for the Undertaker, never lasted long. But they wound up, you know, keeping Kane around and trying to figure out where his place was in WWE. And that goes with that Kane character to begin with. They've never really known what they're going to do with him after that. After that first year, they kind of pretty much lost sight of what the hell to do with him.
And they found, you know, they find interesting things to do every once in a while. You know, every 2 or 3 years they'll find kind of something for him to do, and usually, you know, pretty interesting stuff. So I mean he stuck around for, you know, 14 years now. So
it's definitely, and people still love him. I mean, I know whenever I go to live shows, whenever they hear that pyro go off, people go nuts. So I get it, and it's just been such a long, twisted road for that character.
Absolutely.
And it all started, like, right in, like, late summer of 98.
Yeah, exactly. So we have, as far as the match goes, pretty heavy and intense brawl to start off with, not really a huge surprise. And Undertaker pounds him in the corner to start, scares off Earl Hebner as he is wont to do when the referee gets in his way. I always enjoy that at that spot. And then, okay, this is interesting. Like, okay, Austin reverses, Undertaker clotheslines him down for two, and then Austin flips him off, and then they tie up a little bit. And then they do some, like, chain wrestling for, like, a little bit, which is actually really good.
Yeah, the thing about The Undertaker in the 90s is, you know, he again, going back to what we were talking about, he got put in a situation with a lot of guys who weren't very good. Mm-hmm. And he never really got to show off what he could do. And I think, you know, as Undertaker has, I hate to say aged, but, you know, as Undertaker has aged, I think he's gotten better. But I don't know if it's the fact that he's gotten, if he's actually better, he has a better quality of opponent, or it's just the fact that he carries such a presence now. And I think a lot of it, you know, that presence of the Undertaker has always been there, but really kind of started to bloom around then. And working with Austin, who was so good. And I don't think really at the time, especially, was not appreciated for how good in the ring he was. Mm-hmm. I think those two got to show off some stuff that people didn't expect.
Yeah, definitely. And this harkens back a little bit to the SummerSlam 97 show, and with Bret and Undertaker. Mm-hmm. And that really also showcased a lot of, like, how much he, like, advanced in that. Like, that year since, like, early 96 when he started working with Mankind. Mm-hmm. And started kind of being more, instead of being, like, the sideshow that he'd always been, like, he was sort of back in, working with the mix of the, you know, the Bret Harts, the Shawn Michaels, you know, the different guys as he would work in 96 and 97. And that you could really see that in 97, how much he'd evolved after working with those guys, whether it was working with those guys or whether they kind of moved away from just, you know, he certainly worked the character in, but it wasn't like he was just working the style of match the character would. He had kind of started working the more the realistic style as well.
Yeah.
And I probably just a combination of those things that worked out really well. But yeah, I liked how, you know, there was some of the technical wrestling and, you know, there's really good psychology with working the back here and just some, you know, some neat stuff. But yeah, I loved the early wrestling sequence, Austin working the arm bar, then Taker countering it and working his own arm bar, Austin getting a roll up for two and a drop toe hold, working the arm some more. And I really thought it was pretty cool. And then we get pretty early in the match, we have where Taker puts his head down, and I think they're going to go for, you know, Austin kicking his head, but Austin somehow bumps his head into Undertaker's, and that kind of shakes up Austin for the rest of the match. I mean, it's still a good match after this, but, like, I feel like maybe that kind of slowed things down a little bit, because you could tell that Austin just was, or maybe he was selling remarkably well, but if I recall correctly, he did suffer some sort of, you know, he was off for the rest of this match.
Yeah, And I really like the match. I think the buildup helped the match a lot for me. But I do, when he gets the noggin knocked, I guess is what I could call it. He does seem off. There's really no other way to describe it. It's just he's not bad. It's not even necessarily sluggish. It's just not all there.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree. Yeah, I think there's definitely a change once that happens. And Undertaker counters a suplex into one of his own pretty much right away. He misses an elbow drop, but then catches Austin, uses the stun gun for two. I liked him using one of Austin's famous, you know, this was, of course, the Stunning Steve famous move, but the stun gun's always nice to see.
So, I love the stun gun. It's such a cool move.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I like moves like that that use the ropes. Like, I love, like, the Randy Savage dropping the jaw on the ropes. Like, yeah. I always like that. I love the Tully Blanchard slingshot suplex. Where
can't go wrong with the slingshot suplex.
Yeah, that's a great... Somebody needs to bring that one back. That one's pretty cool. You
know? I even like Orton's rope DDT.
It
just adds that extra oomph to the move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will... I agree with that. So we have... Yeah, we kind of have him working the back... Taker whips Austin in the corner, who collapses down. They end up going outside, although Austin's able to pull the Taker's leg, kind of drops it a bunch on the apron, and then wraps it around the ring post. So we have Taker going after the knee, Austin going after the knee, and Taker going after the back. And we head back inside, and Taker hits a flying clothesline, then goes for the choke. Works the arm bar, then goes for the rope walk, but Austin pulls him off and sort of stomps on the knee for a while. So we have a bunch of sort of back and forth action kind of going on. And then we have Kane making his way through the entryway. And the announcers keep really harping on this. It's Ross and Lawler here. Mm-hmm. And they do keep harping on Kane, like, oh, is he going to be involved? Is he going to be? I guess since this is a good guy versus good guy match, I guess add a little bit of tension. Because I guess there was... I don't know if it was a light or like a medium level tease, almost of like the Savage Warrior at Royal Rumble 92 kind of thing. Like whose side Flair is going to be on. In this case, it was like, will Kane get involved? Will Undertaker turn on Austin, which I guess he eventually did.
Cause they did the thing the next month with the breakdown show where they wound up vacating the belt and leading to Survivor Series. But there was definitely, I remember a lot of tension being like, has the Undertaker and Kane worked out some sort of, partnership?
Yeah. Are they, I believe collusion was the word they would use. I don't know if they use it as much here, but.
Were they perhaps in cahoots?
Yes. Cahoots. That must've been it. Yes. Yes. Cahoots was the, that's right. And I remember that very well now. So, anyway, Kane comes up. He looks like he's going to motion to get on the apron, but then Undertaker tells him to stand down, and then he sort of reluctantly goes to the back. And in fact, Austin sort of he works the knee a little bit more and then takes a few steps toward Kane. And at this point, when he goes back onto the apron, Taker grabs him by the throat and then brings him in for the choke slam, which impressed Jim Ross very much. And me too. He did that at SummerSlam 97 too. That's a pretty cool, like carrying him almost halfway across the ring and doing the choke slam for whatever reason that adds some oomph to it.
Yeah.
And, then Austin clotheslines him over the top, and they brawl a bit in the entranceway, and then they do some token fighting in the crowd, which pretty much every main event of the late 90s, you had to do some token fighting across the crowd.
You got to go in the crowd.
Yeah.
I don't know when that started. I'm not sure like what the tipping point was for we all have to brawl in the crowd at this point, but that became such like a staple of wrestling then, because we had to put it in all the video games, had to be able to had to be able to brawl backstage too. It was just always one of those things that it made its way into every main event, whereas they would go over the rail. And I don't know what kick started that, but you're right, it became a staple of late 90s main events.
I feel like the two major ones that I can think of were the Benoit Kevin Sullivan Falls Count Anywhere one, and then the Austin Hart at WrestleMania 13. Like, I feel like those were the two prominent ones, and then it started happening after that. Like sometime like late in 97, early in 98 is when I feel like it really became maybe the Austin Foley matches were that. That's, might have kind of started there, in retrospect, because WCW, they weren't doing it as much. Like, they maybe did it a little bit later, but I don't know. It felt like, especially in WWE, The Rock, all the Rock Austin matches have it. The Austin Undertaker ones, and it was definitely an Austin thing, which I guess, Austin was the brawler.
We're talking the late 90s,
exactly. So. So they do that. They don't, not a whole lot of note really happens. I guess Austin is backdropped on the floor after he's trying a pile driver. And then he's eventually clotheslined over the rail back into the ringside area, and then gets posted by Undertaker. So Austin is definitely getting brutalized pretty well. At some point, he bleeds from the mouth a bit. And Ross refers to the internal injuries, which I always enjoyed.
If you're bleeding from the mouth.
Internal injuries.
It's not a busted lip. You didn't bite your tongue. No teeth got knocked out. No. It's you're bleeding from the lungs.
Yes. So you are near death. So, then we have so Austin's sort of making some mini comebacks here and there, but it's pretty much Undertaker kind of controlling things. He gets tossed over the top rope and tries to catch the ropes, but ends up going down really hard on the floor. That was kind of a nasty spill he took.
Yeah.
Gets rammed into the steps. Taker, he takes off the tabletop and clears the monitors and chokes Austin a bit. And then I'd totally forgotten about this spot, but he ends up going to the very top and hitting a leg drop off of the
That's like my iconic Undertaker moment. When I know the swan dive at WrestleMania is always fun, but that damn leg drop at SummerSlam, I just remember freaking out when I saw that because it's the Undertaker who doesn't do stuff like that really. You know, he was doing the swan dive occasionally at that point. I think he did it the year before in his first match with Shawn Michaels.
Yeah,
he did it there when he was diving onto like 20 other guys. But diving off that top rope to that table is like, that's just not something the Undertaker does. And it was that whenever I think of the Undertaker, that's one thing that always pops into mind.
Yeah. Yeah. And they both end up slipping over the table instead of breaking
Exactly. Yeah. The table doesn't break because he just like ass slides right into Austin's face.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, it's so brutal.
Yeah. Austin took some licks here. No question about it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. They both beat the hell out of each other. I mean, they were the two toughest guys in WWE. That was the whole point. They're equals. Who's tougher, Austin or Undertaker? And I think they both won that battle.
Yes.
But,
anyway, Taker slips him back into the ring. Austin kicks out at two and, Taker misses a turnbuckle charge, but he's able to work Austin over with some punches. They do the double clothesline collision, which I think it's interesting that that Hebner is willing to count the in-ring countdown when they're both down, but he has no interest in an out-of-the-ring countdown.
Like, no, of course
they
not.
They can roll over all over, and it doesn't matter. But in the ring, you know, if both men are down, we have to do this countdown.
Well, you know, the count out, that's a cop out. But in the ring, that means they're both that tough that they keep each other down for that long.
Okay.
The count out, you know, they're out of the plane of competition. You know, that's too much like rules. That's
okay.
Lame.
All right. Yeah.
that's my justification for it.
All right. Well, that seems not weak at all. So. they both end up getting up. They trade punches, which Austin wins the slugfest, then gets a Luthez press, fists and fire, as Jim Ross indicates. And then Austin is whipped chest first into the turnbuckle, and he tries a stunner, and I'm not exactly sure what happens. I guess the idea is that it was like a jawbreaker, that was a little unclear. It's like almost he hits the stunner, but it's not sold as if it was the stunner. So I get a little confused as to what was supposed to happen or what actually happened there. But anyway, Austin gets two off of it. I'm not sure if you can. I'm sure if you could tell any better what happened than I could. But
I do remember that being a bit of an awkward spot, for lack of a better term.
Sure.
I'm trying to remember if Austin used to do something like the stunner, if you remember the old two guys facing each other, I'll put my head under your chin and that kind of chin buster.
Okay.
But I don't remember if Austin used to do that or not, or if it was just a miscommunication and didn't have anything else to do, so I'll go for the stunner, but we won't make it look like I got all of it or something like
that. Okay. Well, that was fair. And then Austin gets two out of it. Then Taker gets the choke slam. He teases the tombstone, but the choke slam only gets two. He teases his tombstone, but Austin slips out. Austin then tries the stunner, but Taker catches his foot, lifts him up completely, and then drops him crotch first on the ropes. And then he gets a Russian leg sweep and then hits the zombie sit-up.
Oh, the old zombie sit-up.
Yes. And then Taker grabs the armbar, tries the rope walk again, but this time Austin gets a low blow as he's coming down. And then he hits the stunner, and that's it for three. So
I like that you call it the rope walk when we're talking 98 and not old school, as it's known now, because back then it was the rope walk.
No, it was just school. It was not old school. So it was just regular school. So, and then afterward we get them doing the respect thing, which is definitely what I would do if somebody had just low blowed me. And,
it's the old punch to the old punch to the crotch. I'm like, oh, well, you know, you did what you had to do.
Right. I feel like the shot to the balls has been devalued in professional wrestling, especially as I watch these SummerSlam matches, because there's a number of them where a guy gets hit with a low blow and then he's fine like 3 seconds later. So,
yeah,
I don't know if we have anything to say about that, but
now it's always a disqualification whenever somebody uses it, or a usage for a quick roll up. The old kick to the nards just isn't. It's not as fun as it used to be.
No. I think my favorite one is probably Chris Jericho kicking Shawn Michaels after WrestleMania
19. Awesome.
That's probably the greatest one that I've ever seen. I mean, there's some good ones, no question. Owen Hart in particular had some good low blows back in
that
day.
You know what? You're absolutely right about that. I have to agree with that.
Yeah, I remember reading that they actually specifically had several low blow spots in the WrestleMania Bret Hart Owen Hart match because they didn't want it to be – they wanted Owen to cheat as much as possible so it wouldn't be like Bret beating up his younger brother.
I see. Yeah, I remember, you know, that was a whole big to-do with Bret was even agreeing to the match in the first place. So.
Yeah, so – So Taker hands Austin the belt and leaves, but then he and Kane comes out again. They sort of stand together in the entryway, and Austin is celebrating, and that sort of foreshadows what's coming next. Their big three-way feud.
Yes, heading into Deadly Game.
Yes, it was a deadly game. Yeah.
Yes. I really love the SummerSlam 98 match. I think.
Yeah.
If we go from the dark ages of WWE in the 90s, which I would say 93 onward,
mm-hmm.
I would say 98 was probably my favorite SummerSlam main event of the 90s. I did really like Bret and Davey at 92.
Sure.
And Undertaker Bret at 97 was really good as well. Plus with the added drama of Shawn Michaels being a huge dick in that match.
Yes.
I think Austin Undertaker, if nothing else for the build alone, is probably my favorite SummerSlam main event of the 90s.
Yeah, and this was a really good show too.
SummerSlam 98, I would say, yeah, again, one of the best SummerSlams that I can remember, top to bottom.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we have the we had a really good the ladder match, of course. Rock and Triple H. Yeah. What else did they have?
That was like the last ladder match before the Hardys and Edge and Christian really changed the ladder match. I think that was,
yeah,
it was a lot more, you know, brutal as opposed to crazy, which, you know, and I like both. There's nothing against one or the other, but I think that was like the final big old school ladder match. If we want to go back to the...
No, yeah, I like that. I would agree with that. Ken Shamrock and Owen Hart had the Lion's Den match.
The Lion's Den match.
That's actually a great match.
I liked it. It was good. I really think one of the only... And oddly, two guys who I can't stand to watch to begin with, but I liked the X-Pac-Jeff Jarrett match. And at that point especially, did not care about X-Pac, did not care about Jeff Jarrett, but I thought that was a really good hair versus hair match.
Yeah. Yeah, and Jeff Jarrett got a trim, so after it was done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aside from the appearance of the oddities and the goofiness with the Mankind Kane New Age Outlaws thing.
Yeah.
I think for the most part, it's a really good show. Even D'Lo and Val Venus was a really fun match.
Yeah, and that was weird because that was sort of like, okay, D'Lo and Val Venus are like the two young guys who are going to like become really huge stars in WWE. That was kind of the placement of that match, and they had a pretty good match, and then neither one really became a big star.
It's a damn shame.
Yeah.
Well, maybe not so much with Val Venus now because that guy's lost his mind.
Yes. D'Lo,
I love D'Lo.
I love D'Lo too. Oh, yeah. The European title stuff he did, that was so terrific.
I have no idea what happened when he came back for like a cup of coffee 2 years ago and just disappeared again. That was a bummer. Yeah. I really liked having him around. I thought he was I always liked D'Lo, and I again we're talking 98 WWE. It just everything kind of just flowed together really well for this card.
Yeah. Yeah, the I liked all the Nation DX stuff they did in that summer too. That was a fun feud. They really did a nice job, and Triple H and The Rock was a good blow off for that. You know.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
So
it all came together very well.
Yeah.
Summer in '98. You know, summer is usually a big down point for WWE. We talk about this all the time when we do the big roundtable shows.
Sure.
Lately they found like their big let's do a big story. You know, to arc through the show, but top to bottom, summer of '98, they had so much going on, and everything had a reason, everything had a purpose, and it all flowed really well.
Yeah, and the wrestling was certainly improving up and down the card as they were getting a little bit of a deeper roster and building some of the stars. I mean, the Triple H, the Rocks, you know, even, you know, guys like D'Lo and Val who didn't really take off. At least they were having kind of doing interesting stuff. Edge was involved as well. Shamrock and Owen, you know, their cards were starting. They were still pretty top heavy, but they were starting to improve, and it would be a while before they would get like a deep enough roster where they would have like the kind of blowaway up and down shows all the time or almost all the time that they would have like in 2000 2001, but you can see how they were kind of getting there.
Yeah, I mean, if you just go back 2 years and look at SummerSlam 96's card, not nearly even anywhere even remotely close to as strong as the 98 card. I mean, we got stuff like Owen Hart versus Savio in '96. Yeah, you know, the horrible tag team division they had back then with the Smoking Guns and the Godwins and stuff like that. And Sid versus the British Bulldog, which, you know, I love the British Bulldog, but let's not act like Sid is an ideal opponent for the British Bulldog.
I have absolutely no memory of that match. That's interesting.
I only know about it because I'm looking at the Wikipedia page right now.
I
don't remember that match at all. I'm just thinking like there's probably a reason I don't remember that match.
Yes, yes. Well, we had Jerry Lawler beating Jake Roberts in 4 minutes. You know.
Yes, with didn't he pour liquor in his mouth at that?
I don't know if he ever. I think he teased doing. I don't think he ever actually did it, but I think he would hit him with a bottle and did stuff like that. I don't think he ever poured liquor in his mouth. Maybe he did. Yeah. I don't know.
So I mean, definitely the undercards were getting a lot stronger.
Yes.
At that point. And they had to, because they had to compete with WCW, which had the best undercard ever.
Yes.
So.
Exactly. Exactly. So even in '98, when WCW was starting to fall, they still really had, you know, they had the great undercards for quite a while. So.
Yeah. I mean, their main event, WCW's main events were falling apart at that point, but that undercard was so strong, and WWE has always done main events really well, I think. I mean, they know what to put out there.
Well, unless they're Undertaker Kane matches, then maybe not quite this well, but
generally true. Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
But for the most part, WWE main events, that was always their strong suit. So they had to work on building up that undercard.
Exactly. Exactly.
And they capped it off with a hell of a match.
Yes, they did. Yeah, I enjoy this very much. This is definitely worth watching if you haven't seen it before. You know, worth checking out. Definitely an interesting time period in wrestling. If you're not familiar with it, go get some VHS tapes
I believe it's on the Greatest Superstars of the '90s DVD. I'm grabbing it off my shelf right now to make sure. Let's see.
Yeah, I'm sure it's on.
Yes, and I remember it was such a pain for me because I really liked this match and I always wanted to rewatch it, but it's not on any of Austin or any of the Undertaker's DVDs as far as I know.
Oh, really?
And I was one. It was always bizarre to me that they always left that match off because that was such a big deal for WWE, and that was like a big turning point for them because they were, you know, starting to turn the ratings war around, and and they were winning, I think, more often than not. Well, no, that didn't really start till like '99, I think. But
No, you're right. By '98 they were winning more than they were. I mean, they the first win was like April of '98, and they were ahead by this point for the most part, I think.
Okay,
most weeks. So there was when Goldberg won the title, they won that week, and there were a few others. But at this point, WWE was clearly winning, but it was very close.
Yeah, and I think for that match, it was such a big deal, but I really don't think, I know it's not on the last Austin DVD they put out, the big 3-disc set, and I don't think it's on the 3-disc Undertaker set. So I always thought it was weird that match wasn't on there. So I was really excited when I just picked up the Superstars of the '90s DVD one day. I was at like Half Price Books and it was on sale for like $10. I was like, sweet, I'm totally grabbing that, and saw that was on there. So if you're looking for the match, that's the place to get it. And of course, you know, YouTube.
Sure. Yeah, the internet. Yeah, there are other places on the internet where you can find wrestling matches. From what I've heard, people.
Yeah, that's what they tell me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, all right. Well, anything else to discuss as far as the match goes?
Stone Cold! Stone Cold!
Yes.
That's all I got.
Okay. All right. Well, of course, you guys can check out Kick Out Wrestling for many of, if not all, of your wrestling needs. And also, we have go to fairtoflare.com and wrestlespective.com as we continue our SummerSlam main event podcast series. We're counting down all the way through the big event. So keep checking us out every day. And thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Let's be honest. Most wrestling websites suck. BS rumors, schoolyard gossip, plagiarism. It's no wonder why no one believes anything they read on the internet. Well, if you can't get something done right, you might as well do it yourself. Presenting the Fair to Flare Quarterly from the writers of fairtoflare.com and over a dozen other wrestling websites. We're not copy and pasting what we read in some newsletter. This is 100% original content from the best wrestling bloggers on the internet. In-depth analysis of the art of pro wrestling, debate, artwork, and humor. The Fair to Flare Quarterly will raise the bar of what wrestling journalism can and should be. Professionally edited and produced, and every contributor will be paid for their work. Order your copy of the Fair to Flare Quarterly today at fairtoflare.com. The better wrestling media has arrived.